Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you're sitting comfortably. So welcome to the Royal Society Summer Science Exhibition panel session. And if you're not expecting a panel on privacy with technology, where do we go from here? Then go to another room. If you are expecting that, then good. I've been asked to make a couple of announcements. A crucial one is we're not expecting any planned evacuations, i.e. fire alarms. So if there is a fire alarm, please go out the fire exit, which is over there. Okay, so that's so you know where it is. I guess most of you have been here for some time before this panel session, having a look around the exhibitions, which I had a look around, and how marvellous they are. I hope you will agree. I was astounded by the range and depth of the science on show, and that is the main public science exhibition event of the Royal Society. Obviously, if you have feedback about it, we always welcome that. That would be very useful. If you like more or more of the same or less of something, that would be great to know about. Or would you particularly like, of course, the people exhibiting would love to know that. They put in a lot of effort. They're all going to have to get up at about 5 a.m. on Monday morning to get all their kit back to where they've come from so they get out of the way of the Tour de France. So we should applaud them for their dedication to science and public understanding. So my name is John Crowcroft. I'm chairing this session. I won't witter on too long. I'm just going to introduce the speakers, and then each of them will make a five-minute chat about their what they think is a problem, a challenge, or a solution to the area of privacy with technology. And then we'll have a discussion. I have some questions I want to ask them for a few minutes, and then I will throw the floor open, as it were, to questions from all of you. We'll have some roving microphones, so if you want to grab somebody, put your hand up, and I'll try to fairly allocate who gets the next question. So, without further ado, who am I? I'm John Crowcroft. I'm a professor of communications from the University of Cambridge, and I don't do much to do with privacy, so that's why I'm chairing this and not doing most of the speaking. These are the experts. Just going across the room, actually not quite in speaker order. Bashar here is a Royal Society and Wilson Merit Award holder at the Open University. Then we have Stephen Murdoch, who's a Royal Society Fellow at Cambridge University. And then last but definitely not least is Professor Ross Anderson, who's a Fellow of the Royal Society and is extremely well-known Professor of Security Engineering, particularly in that he wrote the book. He literally, as well as figuratively, wrote the book. Which is freely available on the interweb, as we sometimes say. So I recommend that to you if you're interested in how stuff works and you want to do further reading. That would be a good starting point. Okay. So I'll just wait a couple of seconds, hope these people can find a seat. I think there should be enough, hopefully. Okay, so we have three speakers. We're then going to go into a conversational mode. I have some questions for them. And then any of you want to ask questions that come up as a result of what you hear, or even just something that's a burning thing about your worry about privacy. The event details for this, of course, allude to, I love this. This is such a lovely phrase that we see frequently in such things. Recent revelations surrounding internet privacy. What do we think those recent revelations are? And it's not illegal to say Snowden and the NSA and GCHQ, that we just found out they were spying on us all the time. So we're allowed to say that, and I don't see why we have to be dressed up in these delicate phrases, recent revelations. So that's the motivator. But you might have more directly personal motivations that, you may not be a suspected terrorist like we all seem to be now. You may be worried about the fact that people can look at your Facebook pages if you have such things, and you're not sure who those people are, when or why. Personally, I left Facebook 6 months ago, so I have no idea what it does nowadays. So don't ask me. Okay, so we're going to kick off with 5 minutes from Ross. So over to you.
Sure. Security engineering is about a range of things. And as we are basically trying to do practical stuff, we bring in tools from all over, bits of mathematics, bits of physics, bits of psychology even. And one of the things that becomes clear is that doing security or getting privacy is not just about the technology. Now, the technology underlies it. The fact that we can now collect data and process data and distribute data much more quickly and cheaply than before is at the root cause of many of the problems. But there's also a very interesting economic aspect to this in terms of the incentives that cause people to behave in the way that they do. For example, there are institutional incentives and organizations like GCHQ and MI5 to build empires, harm more people, and to find that their work is relevant or supposedly relevant to more and more things. You also have incentives from the companies that sell technology to the government and which often make huge amounts of profits out of selling rather mediocre systems. So there are some very powerful drivers behind the collection of information. But I don't think we can understand this unless we look at the effects of networks. Because over the past 20 years, we've come to realize that network effects in economics really, really matter in the information goods and services industries. They're basically why we see a tendency towards monopoly in the computer industry, software industry, telecommunications industry. And why this should happen is straightforward enough. The bigger a network gets, the more valuable it is to each of its members. If you're on Facebook, then the reason you're on Facebook is because that's where your friends are. 5 years ago, you might have been on MySpace, but then everybody went to Facebook, and there was no point in being on MySpace anymore because there was nobody to talk to. Similarly, people 20 years ago started using IBM PCs rather than Apple PCs because more people were using it. So more people developed software for it. That meant there were more apps, so people went and bought IBM PCs, which meant that more people developed apps for them and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. And so the externalities, as economists call them, tend to create monopolies in our industry. And this is at the heart of the problem we're facing nowadays. We've got a small number of big service firms, such as Google and Yahoo and Microsoft and Facebook, which provide us with free services and as a result have got vast amounts of our personal information. So it's trivial for the agencies to go along and tap them on the shoulder and say, "Hi, here's a warrant. We'd like the Gmail from the following 1,700 suspicious terrorist persons. Thank you very much." And similarly, when we look at networks worldwide, there's a small number of phone companies, there's a small number of tier one ASs, you know, big internet service providers, and again, the NSA can go along and say, "Hey, we would like access to the 30% of the internet that goes through your cable farm in Bude. Thank you very much." And if you're a phone company and you're dependent on governments for licensing, then you don't really have very much choice in the matter. So how does this change with Snowden? Well, one of the interesting things that we find when reading through the Snowden papers is to find that network effects are operating in the world of intelligence as well. So until a year ago, we all thought that the NSA only shared information with four other intelligence communities, with Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Now we realize it's something like 35, or perhaps 65, depending on how you count it. We find, for example, that India used to buy its warplanes from Russia, because although India is a democracy, Russia sells cheaper warplanes, and there's no particular reason not to buy from Russia, provided you can set up a factory to make your own spare parts. But now that we're working in the world of networked intelligence, the Indian intelligence services share information with the NSA, simply because the NSA has got a far, far bigger network than the Russians or the Chinese have. And so what seems to be emerging is a global network of networks that pulls together both the intelligence agencies and the law enforcement agencies of an increasing number of countries. When the police in Britain, for example, do wiretaps, they no longer crawl up a telephone pole themselves and stick the crocodile clips on. They go to NTAC, which is a service window at GCHQ. Why should the taxpayer pay for the same systems twice? And similarly, PRISM, about which we heard so much, is actually an NSA code name for an FBI operation to get information out of companies like Google. So this leaves us with the prospect that we're seeing the emergence of a confederation of intelligence and law enforcement systems that might in time become a new kind of international institution, you know, like the World Bank, but aimed on eliminating privacy rather than eliminating poverty. And how do you go about doing governance on a system like that? Where are the points where you can get pushback? What could an individual nation state, an individual prime minister, an individual Supreme Court feasibly do to push back on this?
Thank you. So, Bashar.
Okay, well, hello, everyone. So I have a slightly different angle on this. So I'm a software engineering researcher, and I I'm trying to find better ways to build software that people want to use and customers want. Now, that sounds fairly straightforward, but I don't know if any of you have ever spoken to an engineer or somebody you want to build a complex system for and asked and told them what you want. You find that it's really hard sometimes to communicate what it is that you want to that person, but also sometimes they misunderstand you. And it's very rare to be able to talk precisely about what you want from a system. And I have a sound clip of a particular customer who's very clear about what he wants. And so I'm just going to play that to you, and then maybe we talk about it a little bit. So if you could play that.
We want this and that. We demand a share in that and most of that, some of this and all of that. Less of that and more of this and plenty of this. Another thing, we want it now. I want it yesterday. I want more tomorrow. And the demands will all be changed then, so stay awake.
Well, with apologies to my two Scottish friends here. Billy has some very precise requirements. These requirements change, and he feels it's right to be able to express them. Now, what are privacy requirements? It's a really hard question. I mean, all of you sort of have an instinctive or intuitive feeling about something that you want to protect. It might be some personal information, some bank details, some location or something. But it's really hard for you to actually communicate that. For one thing, it's difficult to articulate, but also it changes all the time. It changes depending on the context you're in, depending on who you're with, what you're doing. Sometimes information is out of date and is no longer sensitive. So actually being able to talk about privacy or privacy management is a really hard problem for an engineer or a software engineer to be able to deal with, because you can't just ask for requirements for a customer and then somehow expect the engineer to build a system that satisfies those requirements. So I guess my research group and my colleagues and I are trying to find ways in which we can build systems that are adaptive, that change depending on the context that you're in, who you're with. Now, sometimes you'd like to talk to your computer to tell it about what it is that you want. But what do you do if your device is a wearable? Like, you're wearing it here. It doesn't have any buttons or screen or anything. But it's collecting information about you. It's collecting information about how far you've walked, how long you slept. If you have the capability, then you can enter also what you've eaten. So you think, oh, well, that's not so sensitive. I don't mind. By wearing it, I'm okay. I'm okay. I'll allow people to record that. But if I told you what happens if your insurance company now wants to use information about your diet to increase your premium because you're not eating very healthy food, or for example, your parents, you've told them you're in one place and in fact this is saying that you're in another location, and your parents, because they care about you, keep track of your location. You might find that this supposedly harmless information is actually really quite sensitive to you in that particular context, which is when you're going to a party that you shouldn't be going to, for example. So how can I communicate with this device that doesn't have an interface? Or to tell it that this is a particular situation that needs special treatment. So I think in terms of research, what we really need to do is we need to start thinking about software that is adaptable, that's not just specified at the time when you build the system or when you write the software. It's able to communicate with its user, it's able to monitor its environment, it's able to change and understand the context. Now, context is not just a location, it's not just where you're sitting at the moment. It might be a social context. It's who you're with. So it needs to know information about other people. Now, that becomes a little bit of a problem. So if my device knows where I am, I'm happy. I might be sort of, I'm okay with that. But what if it tells me that, what if it tells others that I'm with other people? Or if I'm wearing glasses and it's taking photos of you and you're not supposed to be here? How do you write software where the software's behavior is not only on a single computer, but is distributed among multiple devices over which you have no control? I think these are some of the really big challenges of privacy. And of course, I care about the problems of privacy that relate to government spying and so on. But we have a much more fundamental problem about the things that we buy in the high street that also are exposing us to all sorts of threats. And as an engineer and a scientist, I'm really interested in finding out how we build software that allows us to actually know and become aware of what those devices are doing.
Great. Thanks very much. Stephen.
Thanks. So whether you like it or not, when you're using the internet, you're being tracked. Ross has described how sometimes governments are doing this, but equally other companies and occasionally criminals are making use of internet surveillance. Where this is most visible is marketing. If you have gone online and you've been shopping for one thing, then you might see that every other website you visit is trying to advertise the same product that you're interested in. That's a result of information being collected on you. And that can be a bit of an annoyance, especially if you're buying something as a gift and then the surprise is spoiled when someone else using the same computer sees what you've been looking for. But other times it can be much more serious. There have been reports that Target, the large retailer in the US, is trying to identify whether their customers are pregnant or not, because pregnant women are extremely lucrative for advertising. And they've got access to a vast amount of data. They analyse this and they find out that when someone buys cotton balls and unscented hand lotion, it's likely they're pregnant. And at that point, they send out advertising to this person to try to get them to shop in their store. And in fact, they can work out whether someone's pregnant before often their family realise it themselves. So there has been one case where a woman who was pregnant had not told her parents, was forced into admitting this when her father noticed all these leaflets coming in for baby clothes and other accessories. So this can be a serious problem for these people, and that's just marketing. When we then look at people like governments, not necessarily your own governments, but suppose you are working in a country as a human rights worker, and then the country who's hosting you is doing surveillance on you, they're seeing who you talk to. In some countries, it could be very bad for your health if you're seen to be talking to a foreign human rights worker. That might be cause for you to be arrested, might be cause for something to go, for something to go even worse. If you're a journalist, then your communication patterns, which are observed through internet surveillance, can reveal your sources. If your sources get revealed, then you might not be able to do your job. You might not be able to protect the people who are giving you information. And also just ordinary people going about their business. We've heard of one case where someone was browsing from his computer. His employer was monitoring his behaviour. The employer noticed that this person was looking up web pages about cancer, so they fired him. They didn't want to be responsible for paying his health benefits. Turned out he didn't have cancer. He thought his dog might have had cancer, but he still lost his job. So because of all of these situations, we need better technology to protect people when they're working online. And this is what my research is on. I'm looking at systems like Tor, which is an internet anonymity system. And what this tries to do is give the control back to the individual as to what data you disclose. When you're browsing the internet, there are many people who can monitor you. What systems like Tor do is allow you to control which information you give to what people, under what circumstances, and under terms that you can agree. But there's still a lot more work that needs to be done on this area. So, for example, another source of data is credit card companies. All the major credit card companies have recently changed their terms and conditions, which say that when you buy something using your credit card, the credit card company is allowed to sell that data to someone else. So it's not just, say, Tesco or Sainsbury's who know what you buy, but your card company knows what you're buying from wherever. Could be purchases in stores or it could be purchases online. So it's not enough just to be able to browse the web anonymously, like Tor gives you. We also need to have the ability to make payments online. And that's where systems like Bitcoin and its successors come in. And we also need ways to try to protect people's computers, because one way to break into people's privacy is to hack into their computer, put spyware on there, put adware. Shouldn't there be a better way of arranging computers so that you do have privacy on your own computer and you can try to stop these tracking? It's not going to be easy. It's going to be a long time coming, but if it was easy, then it wouldn't be research.
Thank you. So that's three angles on the topic, or actually a set of dimensions to the topic of privacy and technology. I've got a few questions I'm going to ask all three of our panelists here before we make it open to the audience. And one question I have is something, another piece of recent event, which many of you may have read about, was the European Court of Justice ruling that we have the right to be forgotten. So it's not quite the right of privacy about my data now. It's about data that was public and now should be removed from the view of the public. So what do we think about that, you know, both from a sort of technical perspective, and what are the consequences of that as it plays out? So I don't know who wants to speak to that first, but the right to be forgotten seems to me a very interesting notion, that we're flooded with too much information in the world, and at the very least, just deleting a lot of it automatically would be quite a nice thing, as far as I'm concerned. If most of my email was deleted automatically before I saw it, that would be much better for me. So I don't mind if somebody spies on it if it's deleted, you know, seconds later. So, but actually, that's not quite true. But anyway, what do we think about that? Who wants to have a go on the right to be forgotten?
Well, I thought that was a very interesting ruling. It's going to be a long time before we see the full consequences of it. My views are fairly conflicted. On one hand, I think that people should have privacy, and this is just a particular interpretation of existing privacy law. On the other hand, freedom of information is also extremely important. And if you had corrupt politicians being able to clean up their records retrospectively, then that's not something that's good for society. So I think it's going to probably have some benefits, but it needs to be more tightly controlled. And the current way that this is being done, which is basically Google are making a decision on their own basis, is probably not the right thing to do, because they're not accountable to anyone and they don't have the appropriate incentives to make the right decisions. So I'm hoping something is going to change in that respect.
It's interesting in that this is going to drive an even bigger wedge between Europe and America on privacy law. In Europe, we have got privacy law as a basic right from Section 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. It's now part of the EU treaty. In America, they have a few fragmentary rights on things like video rentals that are always in particular application areas. Now, the big question that's been debated is that if you've got a cloud service type world where there are thousands of companies collect data about you, and there's a few dozen big companies then process it, and there are thousands of companies that then use it, where do you put the privacy controls in, if any? Now, the president in America, the Presidential Council of Advisors in Science and Technology said, you've got to put it at the point of use, right? Because, you know, there are just too many people collecting data, and controlling companies like Google would be un-American. Of course, the European Court of Justice found the other way, and they concluded that companies like Google, which can take 100 completely public and innocuous facts about you and put them together into something very sensitive indeed, have got to be controlled, otherwise privacy is meaningless. And this is completely in line with how we've done things in the UK. For example, the famous case here was Campbell versus Mirror, when the model Naomi Campbell sued and got huge damages from the Mirror after it published a photo of her leaving a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. The Mirror said this was a photograph taken in a public place of on the street of a public figure, therefore there's no way you could suppress its publication, and in America any court would have bought that. But the High Court in Britain found that there was a right to privacy in the circumstances, and that the Mirror violated that right. Now, what the ECJ judgment does is entrench this division between the American approach and the European approach in the law of all European Union member states. So it's going to be interesting to see which way it goes.
So, I mean, the phrase the right to be forgotten is quite a sort of a human one, and for me, it's a bit problematic. So if I told you at the end of this lecture here, you need to forget everything that you've heard, and when you leave this room, you will have no memory of it, you will just laugh at me and you'll think this is not going to happen. And I think we sort of try to transpose it to a digital system and say, if we somehow prevent and, you know, delete information from a database and it's disappeared. Now, of course, in a court of law, a judge can direct a jury and say, please disregard that comment and don't take it into account. But in reality, if information is actually out there, I think it's much harder to control. And certainly it's possible to minimize the impact of potentially damaging information about you personally by having this law. I think the reality is that it's not a panacea, and it's only one step towards perhaps this process of managing privacy. Now, the difficulty is that it's actually almost closing the door after the horse is bolted. What we really need to do is try and find better ways to manage privacy at the point where information is created, not when it's stored. I think that's in itself controversial, of course, and I think many people say it's not realistic, because once information is out there, taking it back is not possible. So, on the one hand, I'm in favor of the notion of the right to be forgotten, but I think it's only an instrument in the hand of the technologists and politicians, who then make a choice actually about when information is available for you or not available for you. And I'm sorry that it's actually a political answer and not a technical one, but that's the reality of a law like this one.
Well, these choices are inherently political. We've got a law, the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, for a purpose. I mean, there was a mate of mine when we were 16. He got fined £10 for peeing in a phone box after a football game, and he was absolutely devastated about it, thought of killing himself, the whole works. And of course, nowadays, everybody can have a good laugh about it. He's got a respectable and well-paid job. But will that be the case for future generations if there isn't some mechanism whereby youthful sins and offences can be forgotten? If when anybody Googled him, you know, they got this report from the Gourock Times in 1972, would he ever have got his decent job in the first place? Then you can either go the way the Germans do, which says simply you won't report criminal proceedings for minor crimes except with a pseudonym, or you have a rule which says, as our law says, that, you know, minor offences for juveniles involving a crime are no longer considered to exist a year afterwards. And you can write software that does that.
So I have a question which I think all of you kind of touched on, but I think it's sort of partly to do with what does the person on the top of the Clapham omnibus actually understand or desire of privacy? And I think this is something that, you know, we're all technologists, which means we have mostly, as you heard, not completely, but at least partly a technological starting point for understanding privacy. Whereas actually it's a word that we use, you know, the keep out, private property, you know, is a word which has one meaning, and or, you know, don't listen to this conversation, it's private, has a slightly different meaning. So what do people understand this to mean when connected with the technology everyone's using every day now? And I think one way of tackling this is the thing that you've all touched on, is what are the consequences for loss of privacy? If you like, this is what some people call the principle of least astonishment, that when you lose privacy, what should happen should be the least astonishing thing. And yet what we hear of these various revelations is actually maximally astonishing. You know, we are astonished that why would anyone have gathered all that data of all our transactions from credit cards? Or why would anyone have spied on every single part of the internet all the time? Why would people devise malware that can run in any mobile device, including a Fitbit, and then broadcast your whereabouts to your parents or guardians, no matter where you are? Why would people do such things? You know, how strange that would be. You know, would your parents hire somebody to go around walking behind you all the time, checking you didn't go to that party? No, but, you know, there's this one way to reason about what people might understand by it is to keep discussing the negative consequences, and particularly the astonishing negative consequences. One I'll just throw in the mix is the government is putting a lot of our data into large online services, and they're trying to maintain its privacy. One example would be the government health care data. In this country, we have such a thing. We have a monolithic healthcare system, and the data your GP has and the hospital have could be combined. And it's clear there are many, many potential health benefits. But there are risks. And here is an example of a risk which may not have occurred to you. There used to be an O-level, GCH, whatever it's called, the GCSE experiment that kids would do, which is to take a blood test and work out their blood type. This was abandoned in schools when kids used to go home and do this with their parents. It turns out roughly 1% of the population of the UK are not the children of their parents. They don't know that. Indeed, in some cases, their parents don't know. This is actually exactly the, you know, one of the cases, kind of case we've already heard about. If you were to accidentally leak all of the healthcare data for the entire population, that how many people is 1% of the population would suddenly discover this thing, which would be quite toxic socially, which in fact they've been getting along fine without knowing. Now, you might morally or ethically not approve of that fact, but it's a reality. And what would the change be in society if such a thing would stop being private information? So that's just an example. So, I mean, if you want to address it, please.
I mean,
just wait until everybody has their DNA sequenced in the NHS and there's a national DNA database. Then you'll be able to fairly simply write a script on that that would look at, for each individual, a few dozen SNPs or whatever. And it would be able to say not only that there are 767,000 people in the UK with misattribution of paternity. Here is the list of their names. Mr. Aaron of 15 Bridge Court was not made by Mr. Aaron, but his father is actually Mr. Jones, who lives at Bridge Street in Coventry. And you could, and the machine could just pull out this whole file about, you know.
I mean, I think they're clearly nightmare scenarios and really really difficult situations we get ourselves into. But you were asking about what the general public, for example, how they make their privacy decisions. And I think a lot of the decisions people make are actually a trade-off. They're not. I mean, we talk about privacy as being the withholding information, but actually privacy is also about sharing information, because we're just as much social animals as we are private animals. And in a sense, we get a lot of social benefit from sharing information. And that's why it's instinctively we want to give out information to people. We want to tell people where we are, what we're doing. I mean, Facebook being a classic example. And it's actually not just simply the threat of privacy that stops us from doing this. It's when that threat suddenly becomes overwhelmingly higher than the social benefit that we're getting. And generally, people are not so great at doing trade-offs in general. But they still make them. And I think we forget sometimes that people are making trade-offs all the time. And wouldn't it be nice if our technology helped us to become more aware of the trade-offs that we're making when we're making these privacy decisions, as opposed to just trying to scare us, which most people dismiss because they're getting an immediate social benefit at the time of sharing.
Great. Absolutely, people are going to make trade-offs. And the way that you find out what sort of trade-offs people are making is you ask them, which is something that until recently computer scientists tended not to do. And when they do, they sometimes get surprising results. So it's often said that younger generations don't care about their privacy. They give all the information up to Facebook. But when people looked into how people use Facebook, actually they're making quite subtle, careful decisions on their privacy. They don't care about strangers. Well, to some extent, they don't care so much about strangers who are watching what they do. And that's understandable, because strangers are relatively unlikely to have any impact on your life. They're someone far away, they don't have any authority over you. On the other hand, children do care very deeply what their parents can see, what other children who are similar ages to them can see. They care what their teachers can see, and we can actually see them making these decisions. But where privacy decisions become more complicated is when the individuals don't have access to the right information. So I mentioned the case about Target, identifying whether people are parents, are going to be parents, sending them baby clothes and vouchers and so on. When this was revealed, Target didn't say, we're going to stop doing that. What they then did was that they disguised the fact that they knew this information. They would send the same vouchers out to this person, but they'd put it along with adverts for lawnmowers and then vouchers for discount holidays. And they found out that not only did people not realise that they're now being profiled, but they actually made more money, because sometimes these expectant mothers were unhappy about being profiled, but now they don't think they're being profiled, but they'll still use the vouchers that they used to. So when there's a lack of information, then making trade-offs is going to be much more difficult.
Very nice example. Thank you. Great. OK, so thanks very much. Now we have... Great, we already have some hands up. I think you were first there and then second there. So. Yes. Yep. Yeah. No, behind. And then here. Yeah.
Thanks, it was a really interesting talk. And I was just interested in what you said about Tor, the internet anonymity system that you're developing. And I've been interested in sort of search engines like DuckDuckGo. I'm not sure how effective they are. You know, it's like wishful thinking probably, but I've started using it. I think it's a bit sort of not obviously as well developed as like Google Chrome and all of that stuff, but I was wondering what your view on it as to how effective it is. And also one other question, sorry, just before, is just how far back can people, because I haven't looked into this properly, I don't know how far back people can like register phone conversations, like read text or read previous searches or previous emails and all of that stuff.
These privacy preserving search engines, they help, they're quite useful, but by using them you've got to put your trust in them. They could be recording your name and all your searches and then sending that off to the Russian mafia for all you know. I've got no evidence they're doing this, I doubt they're doing this, but they could. Where something like Tor is different is the trust in the system is distributed. So the network is run by volunteers, but you don't put all your eggs in one basket. If only a handful of these volunteers are corrupt, then you're still safe. And so you actually probably should be using both. So something like Tor actually uses privacy-preserving search engines as its default. One, because it's good out of principle, and the other one is because Google are not such a privacy-friendly company, and they will, in some cases, block access from Tor to their search engine because they think it could be abused. And so you, in this case, will be using both. And then the search engine will see these requests coming in, but they don't know where you're coming from. So that greatly limits the risk of them misbehaving or someone hacking their systems or all these other bad situations. On your second question about how long people can look back for, it's as long as people are recording this data. And sometimes we know how long companies are recording data, and they might publish that in a transparency report, and that's good. Typically, it's something like 6 months. It seems to be a common one. The Data Protection Act prohibits European companies from storing data longer than they have a business need to do so, and 6 months seems to be an interpretation of that. But there is now European law which has been asking companies to store data for much longer, the Data Retention Directive. This law has now been judged to be illegal, so we're in a bit of a strange situation where these companies are recording data in compliance with a law that is no longer existing, and maybe breaking the law in the process. So this is all starting to go ahead. But that's the companies. The intelligence agencies, we don't know. They could be recording everything forever. When it comes to voice messages and text, the amount of data is so small, they probably would be recording everything forever from everyone.
So, for example, I keep all of my email, everything to me, from me, copied to me, since 1976. So that is, just to say exactly what it is, it's just over 20 gigabytes. So I just bought a new disk to back up my computer at home, which is a terabyte, $50, that big. So that, you know, everything that I've ever typed takes a tiny fraction of that disk. So the agencies that we've been talking about are quite capable of having a very, very large number of those disks and storing everything ever. On the other hand, the constraints on companies are quite good, although they're inconsistent. And this brings up another interesting topic of the consistency of what law applies. For example, Microsoft have been required by a US court to give email from a Hotmail server in Dublin. Unfortunately, while that is a legal requirement on them in America, they're explicitly breaking European law if they do it. So they're in they're an impasse. It's a contradiction, and that's human nature and technological nature when it meets law. It's quite amusing. Now, there are ways forward in that. There was a question here, sorry. And then there's one. And then,
actually, first off, it's probably a good thing there was no sign-up for this session. So in theory, we're all here anonymously, although I'm sure there's a CCTV camera somewhere. But that actually leads on to another thought, is increasingly there's going to be information captured, and not just captured, but probably mirrored and replicated in, you know, myriad places and analysed everywhere. It's a bit of a consequence of Moore's law. It strikes me that maybe the answer from a privacy point of view is obfuscation where possible, and actually trying to come up with, you know, essentially as much fake information in which the real information is the signal is lost in the noise. So I could be posting on Facebook now saying how much I'm enjoying the dinosaur exhibit upstairs, or, you know, sitting outside in Hyde Park. And at that point, there's then conflicting records of where I was at this point on a Saturday afternoon. And you could obviously do the same thing for a whole range of analogous things. I could be wearing your Fitbit and you could be wearing mine. Or, you know, you could have 10 of them around the world with your friends. Do you see that as becoming viable, important, or, yeah, frankly, can people see through all that stuff anyway?
Well, I mean, I think this is a perfectly normal, actually, human type of behavior, and people obfuscate where they are or what they're doing all the time. So I think in many ways the software that we use and that we wear and that we interact with has just become an extension of our social being. And in many ways, you know, to some extent it also becomes the norm. And so we often say, I'm on my way, when in fact I haven't actually quite got into the car yet. But it's becoming harder and harder, because there is the on the other side, there's more and more intelligent computation that is happening. So I know the lady in over there has actually recorded a lot of our stuff on her iPad. I'm not looking her in the eye, but I could see that she was but perhaps maybe first to market, i.e. first on Facebook, has more value and so on. And you're right, it's possible to some extent to obfuscate, to hide what you're doing. But over time, people recognize the excuses. Sometimes the excuses get better, and it's a continuous cycle. And I think obfuscation, anonymization, blurring where you are, so that it says, instead of saying you're sitting here, it says I'm in London, might be one way of, for example, giving out your location, but not precisely where you are, and things like that. And that's certainly one line of research.
That's basically tradecraft for occasional use. If you plan to murder your mother-in-law, you get your mate to take your phone down to Brighton for the day, okay? But it becomes less and less effective,
yeah,
because there's more and more stuff watching. And it's really, really hard nowadays to do tradecraft effectively if someone who puts their back into it, like the murder squad, goes through all the available stuff carefully.
Right. Just next to you, I think, was the next one. And then. No, you're next.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, so I've got one question and one thought. One is, I'll mention the question first. Not the question, my thought first. I mean, the first thing is privacy. I mean, actually, it's a good thing that you can access all the information, because basically that's the way you can catch people who are looking at porn, who are terrorists. So it's a good thing, and I think it should continue. And it's, you know, don't you think? Just a thought. I think it's good. I think the more people have access to information, it's very good. It's a good thing.
So you actually revealed something when you said that's already problematic, which is your definition of, for example, terrorist.
Yeah, I want...
Whose definition are you using? Because there are different definitions. One person's a freedom fighter, another person's a terrorist. So that difference of view... Right, maybe sustainable if somebody that isn't actually about to blow up an aeroplane, they're just talking about it because they're shooting debris and they talk nonsense because they're kids, then you may start to cause a toxic situation where people actually get pushed into a more extreme position because they feel like they better act out this thing they're talking about. There are all kinds of consequences for the direction you're heading. So I agree, it's an interesting point that the more you've got complete surveillance, the more you have a chance of catching bad people. But you have to be really cautious about what the effect is on people's behaviour and who gets to define what is bad.
And what's wrong with porn?
Well, I didn't want to
go there. There is nothing wrong with porn, but...
They should make it legal, then. There's nothing wrong with porn.
I'm not saying that. It's... Isn't it child pornography is the main issue, isn't it?
And there is actually...
That's the main
issue.
Right,
and there's a very specific law in this country that deals with that, yeah. And there's a lot of good things that can be done to catch the seriously bad people in that regard.
Or people who are going to... Yeah. The second question is, like, say, for example, you have an email account and it's been... You haven't used it for a long time and it's deleted. Can you access... Because I want to access my old email account because it's got... specific information that I want to, I mean, but they won't let, I mean, AOL won't give me the, I mean, they just said it's redundant because you haven't used it for a year. So how can you get it back? Is there a way of getting it back?
Well, that depends on the service provider, but actually that's a very interesting question, which is, but it's not strictly to do with privacy, but it's connected very much with the technology that might support privacy. So the idea of keeping archives of everything forever, even when you don't want it available, but being able to get it back, could easily be quite a nice way of. In my view, all personal information should just be forgotten by default. But forgetting would be archiving, and then you, as the status subject, can go retrieve it whenever you like. You just have to prove your credentials. But I don't know what.
Well, I mean, I think the interesting question is who owns that information? Privacy is often, you often talk about privacy as being your personal information. So if someone is storing it on their server, is it now your information or is it their information? So I'm guessing AOL are arguing that it's theirs now anyway, and they can decide the policy. Whereas you're saying, well, it's my information, I actually wrote it. But actually, it just depends. I mean, it depends on provider to provider. And it also, I think it's an open question as to whose information it is anyway.
Well, that's basically sorted by market forces. One reason that millions and millions of people left AOL is that they were a bunch of unpronounceables and that they wouldn't let you auto-forward your mail or download it in a tarball or whatever. And so everybody moved to things like Gmail and Hotmail, which were much more reasonable in their terms of service. So market solution.
A good rule of thumb is that if you're not paying for a service, then it's probably because you're not the customer, you're the product. So if you're using free email or free something else, then you're the product, your information is being provided to advertisers, and so when you cease to be a valuable product, they don't care about you. And that's probably the position that AOL are taking in this case.
Okay, so next and then...
So I work for a media monitoring agency. We take newspapers, we read them, we work out valuable information from that. And I can say that with this clean, good data, it's very, very difficult to pull out anything of value. The data that, you know, stores have on you is nowhere near as clean. And especially when you're talking about, you mentioned earlier, you keep all your emails since 1978, something like that. How much value do you actually gain out of that email? Yeah, and likewise, how much value could the NSA, the British equivalent, whatever, gain out of all this information when it's largely rubbish?
I think we sometimes forget that people, I mean, information about people has value to the person for many different reasons. Presumably, John has sentimental attachment to this information. Perhaps he had some letters that you know, in his I was going to say childhood, but 1978 is. But yeah,
actually, I get requests to write references for people I was teaching back
then. There you
go.
There's
a promotion case. And when I can retrieve something they said and I can comment on it in their reference on that, it makes the reference much more positively persuasive because it has real facts. Yeah. And so I'm using this as an artificial memory extension. Yeah. So it's not sentimental, it's actually a practical value.
I guess my point is that the value depends on the owner of the information. And I think it's not for others to judge its value in the same way as sometimes it's not for others to judge moral reasons for using it. Or
really about how much value can you gain out of this information when it's... You're taking newspapers, for example, you've got a nice, clear definition, this is an article, but you'd also have an agency interested in, I say, the Tesco, interested in articles about them. Yeah. Actually finding just articles about Tesco across all of the UK newspapers is hard. You know, it as a problem to get actual articles that are just about Tesco around Tesco being, you know, the interest that Tesco's got is hard. So how would the NSA or whatever be able to go, well, that's interesting, that data set, that person is of interest to us?
Well, at present, you can put market values on some information. For example, I spoke last year to a guy who builds retail systems, and he says at the moment he can sell your shopping basket for 70p. That's when you go and do your weekly shop. If he's got your name and address and every single item that you bought, that's the bulk value of that to the marketers. However, what he anticipates is that within 5 years' time, its value will be a fraction of a p because it will be sold by more than one person. And it is a feature in the information goods and services industries that, the market clearing price is the marginal cost of production. The cost of copying information is zero. So where you've got cost competition, the price goes very rapidly to zero. And this is another of the things that entrenches monopolies. So you can't talk purely in terms of market prices on a sustainable basis.
I do have a question, but I wanted to tell you an anecdote first. I'm an ex-Muslim, and I have been for over 20 years. I'm an apostate, and I'm proud. But a lot of my family don't know about it for various reasons.
Not anymore.
And one day, my nephew found a video of me asking Richard Dawkins a question at an atheist event. And apparently, you know, that's all on the internet, and anyone could go and find it, which is fine for me because I'm not that bothered. The reason they don't know is because I'm not bothered and they don't want to know. But that, I can see how that would get a lot of people into trouble. And I didn't give permission to anyone to record me, but, you know, it just got recorded. Anyway, my question is, I think privacy is overrated, and I wondered whether you could tell me about some positive impacts of what's going to happen. For example, you know, only 1% of people think their father is who their father is not, but a lot more people having affairs. Do you think one of the impacts might be that we become less, you know, we lose a lot more taboos, monogamy becomes less sort of accepted, and people believe that, yeah, you know, we become a more polyamorous, promiscuous society? I don't know if that's positive for everyone, but...
Well, this is, in fact, something that had occurred to me occasionally. I mean, the old saying among the Romans is mater semper carta. You always know who somebody's mother is, even if you've got no idea about the father. And if population-scale DNA databases means that pater semper carta as well, then perhaps after a few hundred years of adaptation time, South Asian and North African cultures would no longer feel the requirement to keep their women locked up. You've got technology, which is a far, far more certain indicator of paternity. But I don't think culture is that simple. As you'll know yourself, being an ex-Muslim, you know, these things are complex and they can take many generations to work their way through.
We had some questions at the back. I think you were first.
Just a question on how this impacts business. You know, you see Microsoft and Google trying to move everyone to the cloud and also include the unified communication side, so phone conversations and audio conversations all being stored. Do we think that is because security is getting better or because just big businesses want to move people to the cloud, meaning that they're storing large enterprise? We see like pharmaceuticals like Roche moving to Google Apps and things like that with all their information's going to... a Microsoft data center or a Google data center. Is that because security is that much better, or is it because Microsoft and Google are just trying to make money?
Well, things go to the cloud because they're more efficient. You know, you can amortize the costs over hundreds of millions of users. Against normal villains, people like Microsoft and Google can provide much better security than you could on your own. Google employ about 150 people with security PhDs. They've just hired my latest graduand, for example. And your average high street shop can't do that. But on the other hand, you're creating a very, very big target. And the obvious vulnerability is that the FBI goes along and says, warrant.
I'm conscious of time. We have time for, I think, just two more questions. I'm trying to work out. Next. Well, I think you were first, then you were next. So I think that's probably it. So. There's one over there, and then you. So first over.
Hi.
He has a right bias, doesn't he?
No, I'm sorry. There will only be three people put hands up here at all this side. So, yeah.
I just want to make the point. You mentioned how you want to improve the technology that looks after privacy, but when you have governments and companies buying and building in backdoors to encryption programs and software and privacy software, that new technology becomes obsolete, it's completely pointless. So surely the real issue isn't really making technology better, but changing it, changing the world in which we live, the society in which we live, so that the governments aren't exploiting us and aren't trying to control us, because we shouldn't be living in a totalitarian society, and have a society in which companies aren't trying to exploit us, and it's not about consumerism, and the technology is there for us and not for us to be controlled and used as products.
Yeah, I think we need both. We need technology which is robust to people trying to break its security, and plus we need to strongly encourage governments and companies to not violate our security. And one of the things that we're doing in the Tor project is trying to make it easier for someone to spot backdoors. So the way that this is being done is normally when you take some software and then you build it, every time it will look a little bit different. So there's no way of saying that this input corresponds to that output. But we've now changed it. So every time you build the same software with the same input, it will look the same. And we can get hundreds, thousands of people to look at this and then say, we don't find any backdoors. And we can also build better cryptography, which is more resistant to backdoors. The NSA love breaking random number generators, but it's possible to build cryptography which still works even when the random numbers which go into it are broken.
That's great. So question here?
Yes, so one of the assumptions behind much of what you said, I think, is that the entries into databases are in some way valid, and it's just a question of manipulating them. But I think it's obvious that errors occur in databases, and the larger the database, the more errors there are. And if they're interactive databases, the errors will multiply as the quantity of data retained increases over time. So, you think on a few years and so on, and the database is riddled with rubbish. What about that? I mean, how do you expunge the rubbish? And what about data which is deliberately fed in to cause a political result, for instance, or a personal malicious result, because that's there. This is your young man peeing in the phone box. He's there forever, you know.
Just time for a very quick answer to that, and then one last question. So.
Well, there's ever larger and more rubbishy databases, and statistical machine learning techniques are used to extract what they can from it. And as this thing becomes bigger and more complex, it's ever more difficult to link cause and effect. So ideas such as transparency and consent become less effective as means of exercising any privacy control.
Very last question.
Well, yeah, just a quick question, a general question, really. As people at large, not just people such as ourselves that are interested in this subject, become more aware that in general you haven't really got any privacy at all, really. You know, just the man in the street starts to realise that. Will it really start to become socially repressive of the way people live their lives?
That's actually what I was going to choose as a summing up area. So that's really great you asked that there. Does anyone want to comment on that?
I mean, I think certainly over time we're going to be socialised to having more information about us out there. I think that doesn't though stop us from trying to understand what is out there and somehow striving towards more management capability to be able to understand and be aware who's using it for what. And I think it's a non-ending cycle in the sense that what we think, so as we learn that people are using our information in particular ways, we change our behaviors. We no longer rely on the technology to be, as we first when we first adopted it. So saying we're on our way, people, you know, when you're not on your way, people tend to sort of start to understand that in fact that's not a reliable way of locating you, and there might be others. And so it's always a battle, I think, I don't want to phrase it as a confrontation, but it's always a cycle where people adopt technology, it becomes socialized and new norms are developed. But I think there are some basic issues about us as human beings. I think biologically or genetically, there are indications that we have some privacy-sensitive behaviors as animals. For example, we like to be left alone in certain circumstances. We like to socialize in certain circumstances. I think ethically, we have some questions about whether it's our right to have access to other people's private information or whether other the governments. And then we also have laws about these things, and all these are changing all the time, but the biology also perhaps doesn't change as much.
But just to jump in, I mean, I would say that it's very good to try and work with Tor and make Tor work and make it function properly, but you're always going to be in sort of an escalation race where right. people's going to crack Tor and a new version of Tor will have to come out. So you're trying to solve it technologically.
I think we're out of time, but I think that is the key point, and I hope we've got that from all our speakers, which is and all the questions, which are a really great range of questions, which is how broad this is and how the technology is a rather tiny corner of the problem, the social, legal, ethical consequences, how people actually behave, how people will change their behaviour over time, how cultures will change over time. So you've heard that from all the speakers, despite that we're all techno, techie, geeky people mostly, that we've tried to respond to that. And of course, actually, if there was to be a follow-up event, I guess we should get some anthropologists and social scientists and lawyers maybe, if we trust them, and some other disciplines to feed in on it, because I think that's clearly where most people's concerns are. This is part of a much broader debate that's obviously ongoing, and thank you very, very much, and thanks to the speakers for participating.